HPPodCraft.com. George, I wish you'd look at the nursery. What's wrong with it?
I don't know.
Well, then?
I just want you to look at it is all. Or call a psychologist in to look at it.
What would a psychologist want with a nursery?
You know very well what he'd want. His wife paused in the middle of the kitchen and watched the stove busy humming to itself, making supper for four. It's just that the nursery is different now than it was.
All right, let's have a look.
They walked down the hall of their soundproof, happy life home, which had cost them $30,000 installed. This house, which clothed and fed and rocked them to sleep and played and sang and was good to them. Their approach sensitized a switch somewhere, and the nursery light flicked on when they came within 10 feet of it.
Well, said George Hadley.
They stood on the thatched floor of the nursery. It was 40 feet across by 40 feet long and 30 feet high. It had cost half again as much as the rest of the house.
But nothing's too good for our children, George had said.
Welcome back to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast and our themed month, June Companions.
June Companions!
Pretty sure we can cram any story into this theme as long as there are two people that like each other.
Or they don't even have to like each other. Technically, a companion is just a person or animal with whom one spends a lot of time or with whom one travels. So,
right.
Personal feelings also irrelevant. All we need are two characters. They don't even have to be human. This is the greatest theme we've ever chosen for this show.
Wow,
really.
Yeah.
Everything fits into it.
So for this week's story, we're jumping back some Ray Bradbury with The Veldt.
Yeah, I was trying to think of summer stories. This is kind of a potpourri month, and this one came to mind right away, even though Bradbury's got like a million stories that are actually about summer. But mm-hmm. the imagery of that hot sun in this mm-hmm. story, it really always stuck with me, so I think that's why it came to mind right away. And then I thought, well, some of the themes here are definitely relevant to both what's going on in the world right now and for the last couple of decades, so it's a winner.
It is a winner, and you know who else is a winner? Hmm? Our reader.
That's right. Ladies and gentlemen, it's my wife, Heather Klinke, and it's actually our 13th wedding anniversary today.
Aw, congratulations.
Thank you. Well, you know, the traditional gift for 13 years is more work to do from your spouse, so I've roped her in to record today. 13 years married today, praise the Dark Lord. It's a special anniversary. 20 years together total, though. We had our first date, think about this, November of 2000. Our second date, it was election night. That's what I remember about it. So it was when nobody knew who the president was for a while because it was so close and they had to have the recount and all that. So ours was a pact forged in the Clinton era.
Wow, yeah.
That is how lengthy it has been. And we've been through a lot together and we're still getting it done. And I can tell you I love her more every other day.
Oh. So,
I don't even know what that means, but it sounded Marxian, you know.
It did, yeah.
One thing we didn't do was have children, which is an experience that likely will color your reading of this story, I think. Mm. However, as parents will tell you, not having children does not prevent folks from having opinions about how they should be raised. And so this is one that everybody can weigh in on. I believe Bradbury himself did have children by this point. I know he was married in the late 40s and had four kids eventually, so they're... If there were kids, they would have been very young. And this seems like he'd be right at that moment where how you raise your children, that would be preoccupying him.
Oh, yeah.
A lot in those first few years, definitely. I think that's where his mind was. Bradbury, he's very well known for his work set in the future and his ability to predict the future, but he's extremely conservative as a person. You know, we see that over and over in these stories. And in here, he predicts a lot for 1950, but a lot of that prediction is in service of trying to prevent these things. I think, like, Bradbury he himself wouldn't even allow his work published in ebook format for years after that was a way that people were reading because it had to become boilerplate in the literary contracts for him to allow it. And some of that is just insane. Why rebel against people reading it just in a different format? But I certainly can relate to being curmudgeonly about smartphones and television and things like that.
This story was first published in 1950 for the Saturday Evening Post. It was titled The World the Children Made, but had a title change when it was released in the 1951 anthology, The Illustrated Man. Now, at the top, we heard the first bit of the story. A worried mother, Lydia, has brought her husband, George, to the children's nursery. Now, this is no ordinary nursery or house, for that matter, but a home of the future. Everything is automated, and it works a treat. The nursery is special because it can read the thoughts of the people in there, children and adults, but it's for the children, and then it makes it happen. Totally real. It's basically the holodeck from Star Trek, except years early. Yeah. An idea maybe Roddenberry took from Bradbury.
They were very good friends. Bradbury never wrote for Star Trek, even though Roddenberry wanted him to, because he... I always thought that was interesting. He said, oh, I'm terrible at working on other people's ideas. But he did do that with Charles Adams and some other artists. So I feel like he just went, I don't want to write for Star Trek. What am I going to tell this guy? You know?
Sure, yeah.
They were really close friends. I think he was really devastated after Roddenberry passed away. I kept trying to find the passage in here where they talk about, we bought this nursery for the children, but you know, it's kind of fun for us every once in a while. And then he doesn't go into it, but he's like, you know, you can visit anywhere on vacation. And I was like, that's not what you're doing with it, George. Please. Yep. But I'm glad we're covering this because there are a couple other Bradbury stories that cover this the same ground that we haven't done because they're a little slight, like back when we were doing October Country and stuff. Mm-hmm. There Will Come Soft Rains, we've talked about a lot.
Yeah.
And that's the one where there's the smart home, just like this one, that continues working after all of the humans are gone. Wonderful one to read, but I basically just covered it. In that
yeah,
sense.
That's it. That's the whole thing.
But then there's this story, The Murderer. Have you ever heard of that one?
Maybe.
It's completely about smartphones. It's from 53, a couple years after this, but it's about a guy in an asylum, and he's called The Murderer because he'll destroy any device, no problem. He's totally serene because he's finally gotten away from all of the noise that's become commonplace because of technology. So this doctor comes in to talk to him because he's stamped out. He has like an Apple Watch and he stamped it out. That's why he's the murderer. And then, well, here's a couple of excerpts. He's talking about his watch to the doctor. Mm-hmm. He said, when it wasn't music, it was inter-office communications and my horror chamber of a radio wristwatch on which my friends and my wife phoned every 5 minutes. What is there about such conveniences that makes them so temptingly convenient? The average man thinks, here I am, time on my hands, and there on my wrist is a wrist telephone, so why not just buzz up old Joe, eh? Which is totally,
yeah.
I'm bored, I'll text somebody. And then it says, but they went too far. If a little music and keeping in touch was charming, they figured a lot would be 10 times as charming. I went wild. I got home to find my wife hysterical. Why? Because she had been completely out of touch with me for half a day. Remember, I did a dance on my wrist radio? Well, that night I laid plans to murder my house. And that's why he's in the institution, because he destroys his entire smart home because he just cannot handle the level of the cacophony. And if you read that one, I mean, it just lists everything your smartphone does. People always being able to get a hold of you, all of the email, the music, the videos. You know, it's crazy.
1953.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Again, I would have liked to cover that one, but I think I just did in that paragraph. This one has a much more primal thing going on in it. Because this is about what impact is this technology having on our children and parenting. In a way, it's like a think piece for the internet 60 or 70 years ahead of its time. But also it has the basics of child rearing involved in it that have existed as long as humans. You know.
Well, dude, I mean, with the lockdown and everything that's going on, technology has become integral to my education of my children and also getting them the F away from me so I could do some work.
Right, so, I know. That's why I thought this would be such an interesting
story. Yeah, this is really kind of hits the nail on the head here. But let's get back into it.
But this experience is both positive and negative, is what you're saying in terms of...
Yeah. Now, it seems the children, Peter and Wendy, who are both 10, have made the room into an African veldt. And I actually didn't know what a veldt was, but it's just an open, uncultivated country or grassland of Southern Africa.
Oh, okay.
So that's it.
I thought all of Africa was just one bent tree against a sunset. So, I mean, if you trust the movies and advertising and the internet, that's all it is. It's maybe an elephant flapping his ear. You know?
It is super hot in the nursery and the sun is beaming down. That's how real this place is. However, I do have a bit of an issue with the tech explanation, or at least I'm not sure if it factors into what goes on later in the story. I have a lot of questions, which we'll talk about, but I'm pointing this out because this is the first thing that makes me go,
Okay.
The walls were blank and two-dimensional. Now, as George and Lydia Hadley stood in the center of the room, the walls began to purr and recede into crystalline distance. It seemed, and presently an African veldt appeared in three dimensions on all sides, in color reproduced to the final pebble and bit of straw. The ceiling above them became a deep sky with a hot yellow sun. It sounds like they're just walls with 3D projections on them and environmental controls.
Yeah.
Nothing being made. It's not like in Star Trek where they actually beam stuff in and they use force fields to make people.
Yeah, right.
It's just a room with stuff projected onto it. Well, so far.
From what's been described. Yeah, this is 1890s technology, basically. This is the Phantom's torture room with the hot sun and the mirror.
I thought the same thing, too.
Did you? Yeah. But actually, what this reminded me more of was The Mandalorian, the new television show on Disney+.
Yeah, it's totally that. Yes.
Because they've created those super hyper clear screens that they're using instead of green screen effects. They're, you know, they're basically living matte paintings. Mm-hmm. But it says the walls begin to purr and recede into crystalline distance. And I don't know what he means by that necessarily, but I thought that was interesting because they can't scale the tech very fast on these new Mandalorian screens because they have to grow these special crystals to make it as crisp as it needs to be for the camera
it's a TV screen.
So it's actually, they are growing these screens from crystals. It sounds very sci-fi, but that's what they're doing. So Disney's making this holodeck tech right now that comes into play here. But the description of the room hints at something else, okay? So aside from being an excellent sensory description, I thought this paragraph tips towards what the missing component is. It says,
okay,
now the hidden Adora phonics were beginning to blow a wind of odor at the two people in the middle of the baked Veltland. The hot straw smell of lion grass, the cool green smell of the hidden waterhole, the great rusty smell of animals, the smell of dust like a red paprika in the hot air. Oh man, I love all that stuff.
Mm.
Now the sounds, the thump of distant antelope feet, the papery rustling of vultures. A shadow passed through the sky. The shadow flickered on George Hadley's upturned, sweating face. You know, there's understandable tech there. It's in smell-o-vision and all that stuff. But when the shadow passes, it says it flickered on his upturned, sweating face. And I wondered what that meant, because light should be coming and flickering on your face, but a shadow shouldn't pass across his face. Because if a shadow passed across his face, that means that something real passed across between him and the screen.
No, because you would just make it a black spot on it. It's the way it's projecting the light. Black is an absence of light, so all it is that it would create a lighting effect. I mean, that's why the Mandalorian stuff looks so amazing, is because those things actually project reflection. So like on his armor, on his helmet, you can see those things.
And they don't have to light. They can use the natural light from the screens to create the environment rather than lighting and imitation. I know what you're saying, and I think that is the way that I read it the first time. But on this reading, I went, did a shadow really pass on his face? I don't know, because the verb that he used was reflecting. I know what you're saying, that it would look like a shadow, but...
Okay, but still, yes, we'll make a mental note of that.
Let's talk about it more later. Yeah,
we'll talk about it more later. There are some lions in the distance, and they have just... They've just left a kill and are walking over to a watering hole. Vultures have flown down to what is left, and they can even smell the kill and the blood, the lions, the vultures. It all feels very real. Lydia is worried about the kids and that this stuff is going on in their minds. It's got gore and murder, and it's hot. George tries to put her mind at ease, but the lions notice them and begin to approach, and this scares Lydia, and she runs, and George just runs too, because... You know, she's running, he gets scared, and they get out of the room. George laughs, but Lydia is crying. She hates the room.
Every once in a while, I'll walk into the living room while Heather's watching The View, and it is the same reaction. Whoopi and Meghan McCain seem so real.
I just run out. She tells her husband not to let them read any more about Africa, and he promises. George tells her that she's stressed and needs to relax. Lydia says that's not the problem. It's that I'm doing nothing. You know, the house does everything. The housework, the cooking. Of course, this was written in the 1950s. And it even takes care of the children. George realizes that he, too, has become reliant on the tech, and he's become lazy.
He's become lazy, but I feel like that was there to begin with, you know? They went into it with the wrong attitude. If I had my house, I would love it if my house did all this stuff. Tied my shoelaces? Are you kidding? That's great. Because I want to spend my time writing disco songs about monsters or something of equal value to that. And he says... It actually says, I thought that's why we bought this house, so we wouldn't have to do anything. So I don't really know if the tech is to blame here.
No.
You know, tech is like any idea. Once the toothpaste is out of the tube, you can't really put it back. I think the only thing we can modulate is how we use it. You know, this house didn't make him lazy any more than a bar makes somebody drunk. It's just like how he decided to conduct himself once it was in place. And then there's a little FaceTime action here. It says, at dinner they ate alone, for Wendy and Peter were at a special plastic carnival across town and had televised home to say they'd be late to go ahead eating. So George Hadley, bemused, sat watching the dining room table produce warm dishes of food from its mechanical interior. Ah, we forgot the ketchup, he said. Sorry, said a small voice within the table, and ketchup appeared. I was really disappointed we weren't going to learn more about this over-apologetic dinner table. It was sort of like the robot that passes butter in Rick and Morty.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like this dinner table should apologize too much. You know, George is watching TV, and he's like, oh, man, I missed the game. And the table's like, sorry. He gets mad. Why are you sorry? It's not your fault. Oh, I could have reminded you. I mean, what else am I doing over here? You know, and then George has to spend all night making the dinner table feel better again. Side plot.
During dinner, George is really bothered by the nursery, and he goes in to try and change it into some other thing. Maybe Alice in Wonderland, Oz, Dr. Doolittle, they bring up these references, but nothing happens, just the hot veldt. The room seems to be broken.
He's bothered that the kids are so fixated on thoughts about death. They were awfully young, he thinks, Wendy and Peter, for death thoughts. Or, no, you were never too young, really. Long before you knew what death was, you were wishing it on someone else.
So he gets back to dinner and he tells Lydia that it seems to be broken. Maybe the kids have been thinking about Africa so much that it stuck on it. Or maybe they've tampered with the system, but they're only 10. But then again, they're pretty smart. So are they actually pretty smart? That's something I wonder about as well.
It seems like having everything given to them would probably make them not that intelligent. But deceit, it's a form of intelligence. You know, if they want to continue to use this technology however they want to, they certainly would then be motivated to learn how to do that. And so, this is a really interesting thing because there is a technological gap. If something wasn't a technology you grew up with, you're never going to be as adept with it as a younger generation. So it's very easy for these kids probably to create whatever, you know, to tamper with the system however they want. And the parents wouldn't know necessarily what they did.
Yeah. I'm unsure of how smart they are. And obviously intelligence has nothing to do with technology. My boy, I'm going a whole other thing talking about intelligence and technology, but I'm not going to. We're going to talk about
the story. Well, it just seems that at 10, it is not beyond their capabilities to alter the parameters of this room, I don't think.
No, I would.
I mean, my own smartphone, I think my nephews were teaching me about when they were 7 or 8.
So finally, the kids come home after having hot dogs and strawberry ice cream at the carnival.
Says they took a helicopter home, which I'm assuming is cool jargon for something other than an actual helicopter, because that would be a little disruptive. I think maybe it's like a little drone hawk that picks you up and drops you off somewhere or something.
I like that. George asks them about Africa, and they don't understand what he's talking about. They know nothing about it, or at least they seem to. George doesn't believe them, so Wendy gets up and goes to take a look. When she comes back, she says, it's not Africa. And of course, George knows it was Africa, so he goes in there and checks it out, but it's not. It's this nice forest. And they say, Rima is there singing a lovely song. So I thought, who the hell's Rima?
Me too.
There is a Rima that I found called Rima, the Jungle Girl. And this was from W.H. Hudson's 1904 novel, Green Mansions, A Romance of the Tropical Forest. I'm reading this from Wikipedia. It is a romantic adventure set in the South American jungle in which a political fugitive named Abel meets Rima, a girl living in the forest. The girl speaks in a bird-like language. Its theme is the loss of wilderness and the return to nature dream, and how unpleasant it would be for a savage to meet modern man. The reverse case is not considered. And I think that's obviously a thematic link.
Yeah. Pretty romantic, too, if you think about it. Abel approaches this mysterious girl in the forest, and he says, you're so beautiful. What is your name? And she says,
Yeah.
So beautiful.
George isn't sure if they're lying about messing with the system, so he just sends them to bed. On the ground, he looks down, and he finds his wallet, or an old wallet of his. It smells like Africa, not the forest, and it looks like it's been chewed on by a lion, maybe, and it's got blood on it. Mm-hmm. Now, again, I'm not sure what this is. It's a clue that we're going to need to look at after we talk about this whole story here. But there's a physical object that has been bitten and it's got blood on it.
Yeah. So things from the imaginary world are bleeding over, I guess.
I don't know. But there's blood on it. Moving on, George and Lydia discuss what to do about this room and the children. George thinks they should go on some trip together. Disable the nursery, maybe? He's not sure. He thinks the kids are too spoiled, and then he hears screams, and they think the kids got into the nursery. Lydia says the screams are familiar. Again, important. They recognize those sounds.
Yeah, at this point, I just assumed it was because they were from some James Brown record that's been sampled over and over. Like, everybody uses that one from Sex Machine.
That's what it is, Sex Machine. Okay, I just assumed that. Yeah, because now I understand what the story is.
That's the key.
Sex Machine. The next morning, George has a conversation with his son about not being so reliant on technology, to which Peter is annoyed and confused by his father's distaste for Africa. His son even says, I don't want to do anything but look and listen and smell. What else is there to do?
Yeah, and that's following an interaction that I think gets to the heart of this story. The kid says, I didn't like it when you took out the picture painter last month. And George says, that's because I wanted you to learn to paint all by yourself, son. I think that's where the convenience of technology specifically applies to children and education. And yes. It's something that's on us to do. It's not the technology's fault. We need to handle it the right way. Because convenience is best when it's earned. You know, i.e., you know this is convenient because you've had to do it the inconvenient way. There's a lot of stuff I appreciate because I used to have to do it by hand. And even outside of the tech realm, I just heard it last night, the Michelle Obama documentary, the new one, was on in the other room, and she was talking about going to the White House and telling the staff, I don't want you to make my kids' beds and clean their rooms because they've got to learn to do that for themselves. And of course, our girls were like, but you're cool with them cleaning your room and making your bed. And she's like, yeah, I earned it. There's a difference. She had to go through it when she was a kid. So it's okay for her to. And I think that's true. And this happens culturally as well. Think of people who had to fight so hard in dangerous times for women's rights and civil rights and gay rights. But then new generations who take that struggle for granted in certain cases. And it can be a resentful issue, an issue of resentment for the older generations. You don't know the struggle that went into it. Yeah. And so we're playing in the sci-fi field here, but this is a pretty primal child rearing issue. That's what I meant. You know, I want your life to be easier than mine, yet making your life easier makes it harder in the end because you don't value what's been given to you. So I'm invested with more love than I ever thought possible for this being, which makes me the best candidate to protect them. However, due to this love, I am now very ill suited to raise them because inflicting struggle breaks my heart, right? Yep. Like I should have the ability to discipline or remove pleasures, but I can't do it because I want to indulge this creature. So anyway.
Yeah. You know, when that whole, it's going to hurt me more than it hurts you sort of thing.
It's true, right?
Yeah. They need to be punished because if they're not going to be punished, I wanted them to have fun and be happy and do all those things. But if I don't set boundaries and enforce the rules, then they're going to be jerks.
Yeah.
I can see it makes them sad. I don't want to make them sad. It hurts my heart when they're sad.
Yeah.
But I really don't want them to be jerks. So you got to come down hard.
That's where a robot, you know, it would be great if we could have a robot that did all of that stuff. And then you could go, I don't like what the robot's doing either.
Yeah, that robot's the worst.
That would be the best alternative.
So Peter goes and plays in the nursery when David McLean comes by. He is a friend and psychologist who recommended the nursery. He tells George, the usual violence is a tendency towards a slight paranoia here and there, usual in children because they feel persecuted by parents constantly. But, really nothing.
Did you watch that Toys That Made Us show?
The
psychology behind He-Man was that boys are sick of being told what to do by their mothers. And so that's why the catchphrase was, I have the power. Like, this is going to really resonate with boys who are powerless all the time. And, you know, it certainly did.
Well, they hear the screams from the nursery again. When they get there, they can't tell what the lions are eating, focusing on that again. So David tells the children to go. He wants them to leave the images on the wall, and they do. He said, I wish I knew what it was, said George Hadley. Sometimes I can almost see. Do you think if I brought in a high-powered binoculars here and... Because they were trying to figure out what it is that they're eating, these lions.
Yeah, yeah,
David tells George that he should stop letting the kids use the nursery. They're angry at their father's perceived slights.
Very typical stuff. He didn't let them go on a field trip. He's taking some devices away here and there. There's like an entire YouTube genre of children losing their shit because of these things. Videos of kids freaking out. And it's really funny because you know they'll get over it, but also because they don't have access to lions.
He says, you've let this room and this house replace you and your wife in your children's affections. The room is their mother and father, far more important in their lives than their real parents. And now you come along and want to shut it off? No wonder there's hatred there. You can feel it coming out of the sky. Feel that sun.
We're talking a lot about smartphones, but I think Bradbury's direct anxiety is the television, which was just starting to kind of poison homes in the late 40s and 50s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in Fahrenheit 451, everybody's obsessed with ripping out walls to put in new large flat screen TVs. So it's not just one big flat screen TV. They're everywhere. He's also got this story called The Pedestrian, where a man is arrested for taking a walk and not owning a television. And there's a great bit in there I think about all the time. It's this paragraph where he compares a neighborhood of people watching television in their living rooms to a tomb. It says he would see the cottages and homes with their dark windows, and it was not unequal to walking through a graveyard, where only the faintest glimmers of firefly light appeared in the flickers behind the windows. Sudden gray phantoms seemed to manifest upon inner room walls where a curtain was still undrawn against the night, where there were whisperings and murmurs, where a window in a tomb-like building was still open. TV seems like an antiquated adversary to culture, you know, now that we've got the internet to contend with, but I think we're just in the middle stages of being ruined by television. You know, it's a little bit of, it's how drugs work. You know, it was a lot of fun for a while and a good release, but then eventually you do enter that binge stage.
Yeah.
And I think that's where we are now, where we're so up in the drug television's ass that I can't tell what's real or not anymore. That, you know, like if Alf became Secretary of the Treasury, I wouldn't be that shocked. I guess that's where we're going with this. That's, you know.
Can we do that? And I mean, like, to make that happen.
The cat lobby. Are you kidding me?
Well, yeah, that's true. There's a lot of people. But no, but to make that happen, we would have to find the guys that wrote Alf. Mm-hmm. And the puppeteer and Bill the puppet. Like, I'm serious. Like, let's make it happen. And well, why not? I mean, like, what is politics seems to be insane.
Yeah, no, actually, like, I just think Secretary of the Treasury is shooting too low if you're really committed
to
this. It's too
low. Because Alf could be, obviously, he would still be a puppet. And these guys, he would have writers and a whole, you know, like a staff of writers that would come up with stuff for him to say and things to happen. And but I would feel more confident having a staff of comedy writers behind.
That's true.
Running the country than any of the people that seem to be running the UK.
But you know what? When people run for campaigns, they do have a staff of writers and then they still lose. I think that having the comedy writers, what that's going to help us with is romance. So we need to get Alf married up in a monarchical system. Screw these elections.
Oh, right.
Yeah. He's got to get in there, knock some people out of the way. King of England.
There you go.
We better not leave this in the show because if people get wind of this stuff.
I know. This has got to go out. We can't have this in there.
We're going to get in trouble.
How would Willie Tanner feel about that? That's what I want to know. So David says the kids should be taken away. They should go on a trip or something together and the nursery should be shut off. Before they leave, David notices a bloody scarf that belongs to Lydia.
Again, like the wallet, it's some e-voodoo.
Again, it's a physical bloodied thing. It's blood. They both go to the fuse box and shut down the nursery. The kids go nuts and they throw a big fit. They hate their father for doing this. I wish you were dead. And George says back to them, we were for a long while. Now we're going to really start living. Instead of being handled and massaged, we're going to live. But with some begging and pleading, he lets them get into the nursery one last time.
Because everybody's always really moderate the last time they do something. So this is a good idea.
So George starts shutting everything down in the house, all the machines and plans on a trip to Iowa with the family.
Which kind of implies that Iowa is the opposite of stimulus, you know? We're going to go. We've been so entrenched in these exciting things for so long, we need to turn around and go to Iowa, which would have made me mad if I didn't know that he was from the Midwest, you know? I'm married in Iowa. It's not so bad. I like it there.
Man, most of the time I went to, well, obviously not when you cross the river, but like when you go into deep Iowa, usually it was the sticks where my aunts and my grandmother lived. There were small, quiet, rural towns, farm towns.
Yeah, but you saw Styx play there.
I did, and they were awesome. So Peter and Wendy call for their folks to come into the nursery. When they go inside, they close the door and lock their parents in. The lions approach George and Lydia. Mr. and Mrs. Hadley screamed, and suddenly they realized why those other screams had sounded familiar.
Well, here I am, said David McLean in the nursery doorway. Oh, hello. He stared at the two children seated in the center of the open glade, eating a little picnic lunch. Beyond them was the waterhole and the yellow veldland. Above was the hot sun. He began to perspire. Where are your father and mother? The children looked up and smiled. Oh, they'll be here directly. Good. We must get going. At a distance, Mr. McLean saw the lions fighting and clawing, and then quieting down to feed in silence under the shady trees. He squinted at the lions with his hand tipped to his eyes. Now the lions were done feeding. They moved to the waterhole to drink. A shadow flickered over Mr. McLean's hot face. Many shadows flickered. The vultures were dropping down the blazing sky. A cup of tea, asked Wendy, in the silence.
And that's the end.
And that's the end of the story. Now, the lit studies that I've read about this seem to be fixated on the idea. It's just about tech. Tech is bad. And if we let ourselves get too reliant on it, it'll be the downfall of humanity or some other such thing. And of course, that the idea that George and Lydia were killed in the room somehow. But that, to me, doesn't really answer any of the questions. We've got a bloody wallet and a scarf. Mm-hmm. And the screams were familiar to them. Not being able to figure out, you know, the lines were, it was them. So all of this, to me, when I was doing my notes, felt like this is something that had already happened because there's physical objects that have blood on them. This is just a room with walls in it. It's not it doesn't do anything else as from what was described at the beginning of the story. Maybe there are other abilities that we're not privy to as the reader that somehow, but somehow lions manifest and then kill them and then that be brought into it. It all didn't quite fit for me. So this idea that I put to you is that, and I feel like it's not right because it doesn't fit the theme of everything else, but maybe they didn't actually exist in the house. They did exist at one point and they died, or they're actually part of the automation of the house. And if it can generate stuff in the room, they're objects, and maybe they were never actually physical beings in the room, because the way the kids interact with them, George and Lydia never leave the house. Like, maybe they're constructs. Maybe they're not their actual parents. They're just kind of the house's version of the parents that raise the kids.
Right. I never thought of that, but hearing it, I mean, it's like a really cool idea. That I could see how you could make a case for that, for sure. I don't think that was the intent. What I got from it, so there's a leap into the technology that we can't explain, and I think that that's known by him as well, and it could be even supernatural. And I was very confused by it when I read this when I was a kid, because I just wanted to know, how did the lions become real? In taking out their aggressions against their parents, the kids created their parents in the simulation. And this room reads minds.
Yeah.
It does things like that. So it does take data from your physical body in some way. It takes data from personal objects, perhaps, to create a more real version. So what they couldn't do just by describing their parents was better done by having the scarf and the wallet, so that the thing could analyze DNA and recreate those people in a very real way, which they then could set the lions off on them to do. And like, if it can interact with the real world in some way, what I thought is maybe the lions are so now used to killing those simulated parents that the simulation wouldn't know the difference from the real parents and would move to kill them. Now, how is the simulation able to physically interact with the world? I have no idea.
Okay.
You can say that it was all virtual as a way to justify it, but I don't think so. I think this is a Nightmare on Elm Street situation where it's like the dream just crossed over into the real world and we don't know why.
Know? Okay. So it's more...
But it's just a bit of magic.
More on the fantasy and less on the hard science fiction edge of things.
I think so. And also, you know, maybe I'm looking too much into it, but I think what I was talking about earlier about how children understand technology better than us, I think as the reader, we're meant to be put in that position where it seems like we can tell just the kids, we can just unplug this thing and that's how we win because we have the power. But since we don't have the understanding of the technology, that's not true. The kids have the power. So they know how to program it to make the lions come out and kill you. Or maybe there are, like, if you think about when you go on a Disney ride or something and they shoot compressed air at you. When I did The Void with the Star Wars, we did that together, right? The Star Wars thing?
Oh, yeah.
There are actually, it's virtual reality, but they put physical objects in the room to improve the reality of it. So when you touch this R2 unit here, you actually feel it. And you take the glasses off, you see it's just a lump in the room.
Yeah.
But does this thing manipulate physical objects with a power and the ability to actually bludgeon somebody if the lion were to decide to eat them? You know? That's what I thought might be going on. Because they've got Odorama and they've got winds blowing and the heat.
Yeah.
They've got heat in there. So there's so many things happening like that.
But all those... See, I guess it's just my sci-fi nerd brain is just that. It sets up, this is what it can do, and then it does something so far beyond what it initially sets up that it can do. Like smells, faking smells, that's something we can do now. And controlling the temperature and the humidity in the room to make it feel like you're...
That's I do all that to gaslight Heather all the time, yeah. That's normal shit.
Yeah, but then they would take this leap to, like, somehow the kids are able to kill them with the room. The room somehow is able to murder them and they get rid of the... So maybe I'm making that jump, because what happens is they're put in the room and then they're locked in the room and they can't get out.
Like Phantom of the Opera.
Like it could be, honestly, like Phantom of the Opera, and the kids just jack up. They don't say that they're killed by the lions. That's something that we've made a leap to.
That's right.
So if the kids actually killed them, they could have just cranked up the environmental controls to the point that they roasted and died, and then the kids could have carted out their bodies and processed them with the other thing. So the way the writing was going, it made me think that the lions came to life and killed them. But that is never directly said. That's an assumption that I'm making.
None of this matters so much, because this whole story is really just a setup for, you know, this guy that comes in the end. They say, oh, our parents will be along shortly. really, they're just waiting for the lions to get hungry again because they got to kill this guy now that he knows their parents aren't there. So this is all just set up for a hilarious farce where people keep showing up and the children keep feeding them to the lions. I don't think Bradbury ever got to that story, but it's kind of a Three's Company-esque hilarious.
Yeah. With Bradbury, there's a lot of room for interpretation, and I'm not exactly sure what was intended by what he wrote.
I think what was intended was to create the very debate that we're having and to say, you know, you can text while you're driving, but that doesn't mean you should.
Yeah.
You know, technology, if you have it, it's convenient, but don't use it just because it is convenient. I think he makes that point, and that's what he wanted to carry through. He's a very confident writer because he goes, and if there's something I can't explain, I just won't. And to me, that's a mark of confidence always.
Sure.
Let them do the work for me. I don't really need to get into this. So I think that's cool. And that's why this is kind of a classic in his repertoire. Gets taught a lot, and I can see why. I'm glad to talk about it. I don't know what we're going to talk about next week. We're kind of going seat of our pants on this one.
But I want to talk about our awesome reader, Heather Klinke.
I do, too. Thank you so much, sweetie, for doing that again, and I love you.
Of course, I want to thank our patrons. We got some wonderful patrons here that I would like to name specifically and say thank you to, like Becky Maris. Thank you.
Michael Jarka, thank you.
Thank you, Matthew Pendlebury Ward.
Thank you, Hamish Dixon.
I'd like to thank Jeff.
Emma Dermott, thank you so much.
Bill Sturgeon, thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Jelev, thank you.
Jacob Klapik, thank you.
And Chris Hibbett, thank you. That's all we've got for this week. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast
at hppodcraft.com and Patreon.